you're seeing a lot of companies now kind of slapping AI ops onto their platforms and their products. And that's creating a massive amount of confusion. You know, people are just kind of, our customers are just like everybody's AI, like all their existing vendors now are like, oh, we're AI ops now. It's like, okay, but you haven't changed anything, right? You're still a legacy vendor that we've been having for 15 years. You haven't even upgraded software in 12 months, like, but now you're an AI ops platform.
Welcome to the All Things Ops podcast. On this show, we interview leaders in IT operations, DevOps, and AI ops about the ever-changing world of running an organization's technology. With our guests, we dive into things like, what does it mean to run large-scale IT infrastructures? How do you manage globally distributed operations? What are the complexities of hybrid IT? How can you best leverage automation? And last, but definitely not least, how do you keep an eye on things using monitoring and observability? This podcast is produced by Tribe 29, the company behind CheckMK, the software of choice when it comes to monitoring hybrid IT infrastructures. I'm Elias Volker, and I will be your host today.
Welcome, everybody. My guest today is Sean McDermott. Sean is the founder and CEO of Windward Consulting, an IT consulting firm specializing in IT operations and AI ops. We'll talk a lot about this today. He's also the host of the AI Ops Evolution podcast. Sean has really seen it all. He's worked for the federal government, has founded multiple companies. One of these companies, RealOps, was acquired by BMC, where you then served as a VP for some time. He then went on to found or co-found at least following my count, three more companies. And all the time you've been running Windward Consulting alongside that. That's pretty impressive. Sean, welcome to the All Things Ops podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
All right. Yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself. I mean, I did a quick intro, but how did you get to where you are today?
Well, you kind of summed everything up well. I started out in the federal government. I think that's probably the pivotal thing is when I graduated from college with a electrical engineering degree in the late 80s. I serendipitously fell into a government position working in their telecommunications department. And we designed most of the communications for the Bureau of Prisons, U.S. attorneys, all the basically legal aspects and of the federal government. That led us to really the internet. And so when I was there in the late 80s, early 90s, we did transitions from X25 networks into IP. We were one of the first civilian agencies in the federal government to actually deploy our own private IP network with this little company called Cisco at the time. And I actually started the internet connection at the Department of Justice. I had the first internet connection actually ran on an old SCO Unix box under my desk and sent the first email, registered the first domain. So that was really the beginning of it. And, you know, what I always was fascinated by and continue to be is, you know, most people are really excited about building networks and building next generation networks. And that's exciting. I've always been kind of fascinated by the manageability of networks. And the thing I noticed in those very early days was we were building out these IP networks very, very quickly. But we didn't know how to manage them. Like we had really no idea. And there's very few tools. I mean, back in the day, it was like HP OpenView and IBM NetView, which was an OEM version of OpenView. And the tools were very rudimentary, but the networks are very rudimentary. And that has basically kind of continued on through the theme of my career of how do you manage these networks and as networks and infrastructures and now cloud and SaaS and platform as a service and infrastructure as a service have all become super, super complex over the years. We've just kind of migrated along that path of always asking the question, what's the best way of managing this infrastructure? And that led to, the formation of Windward back in 1997. So 25 years ago, we started Windward. And during that course, we started thinking about automation, and that led to the creation of RealOps, which was the first runbook automation orchestration platform on the market. And that was bought by, as you said, by BMC a few years later. So that was a pretty quick turnaround on us building technology, taking it to market, and then getting acquired. That led to App 47, which is mobile application management, because we started thinking about how do you manage mobile applications in the commercial, in the enterprise, because most people were building applications for consumers. And we were looking now, we're seeing our customers starting to build custom applications, mobile applications for business reasons. And how do you manage that when you don't want to deploy those applications on Google Play or the App Store? You want to privatize those. So that led to that, and that led to App Red Monocle, which was managing cybersecurity and the security aspects of kind of cybersecurity investment strategy. So everything's kind of led off of that initial question of like, how do we manage this stuff? And it's AI ops is right along that way. It's like we're now looking at AI and machine learning coming into the operational enterprise. How do we manage it? You know, what does it mean? What is the strategy? What's the vision? And what are the technologies, and how should we approach it? Because I truly believe that AI ops is, you know, having been in this space for 30 years, is really one of the few transformational things going on in the operations environment today. It's going to have a huge impact in the coming years.
All right. Well, we talk about that in just a little bit. We'll definitely get back to that. Windward Consulting is, as I understand it, it's an IT consulting firm, and where you help your customers, as you said, you know, how do I manage all of this? So, yeah, tell me, what do you guys do? What customers do you typically work with?
Sure. So we are a we focus on operations management. So again, back to that theme. And really, it's all about how to manage this complex infrastructure. And we really kind of focus on four primary areas when it comes to operations management. IT service management, and we're a big partner with ServiceNow, and we're a lead partner with ServiceNow. Operations management, and really what we consider kind of monitoring, observability, and that kind of space of data collection and event management. SecOps, which is really kind of merging in with IT operations right now. And the last area is really is AI ops. So this is kind of the area that we're spending a fair amount of time on right now. Most of our customers are Fortune 500. As I tell, you know, as I tell people about Windward, we operate on scale, right? So when we work with customers, these are customers with huge global networks, massive data centers or massive cloud environments now. And really, they have the same problems as smaller enterprises. But when you enter into the scale, then it makes everything exponentially more complicated. And that's really where we play. So we work with, you know, we've probably worked with 300 of the 500, Fortune 500 in the US.
Oh, wow. That's pretty impressive. You mentioned that you do a lot of work in AI ops, and I would like to focus a little bit on that. So, I mean, this term has been floating around quite a bit, but in my experience, not only when it comes to AI ops, but AI in general as well, people mean very different things when they say and throw out the term AI ops. How would you define it?
And that's an excellent question, right? Because you hear people talk about, you know, AI and the traditional artificial intelligence. You talk about augmented intelligence. I've heard automated before. You know, I'm fine with the kind of the connotational AI of, you know, like what we think about artificial intelligence. But what I tell people, and I tell our customers, is that it's not really AI, right? I think at some point we're going to get there. So kind of using a more aspirational term of artificial intelligence. But right now we're really in this kind of world of machine learning. And so I don't get too caught up in exactly what the acronym means. I try to get our customers really to spend more time. I'm thinking what we're talking about is augmenting the human experience, right, with machine learning or in the future AI, or true AI, which I think we're going to get there. And we're already seeing that in some places. And really kind of then getting them to say, okay, what we're talking about is bringing in a new condition into the operations environment outside the human condition and using that to our advantage. I think the biggest challenge going on right now in the market, which is unfortunate, is that the term is starting to be overused and it's being really, it's almost becoming marketing jargon now. And you're seeing a lot of companies now kind of slapping AI ops onto their platforms and their products. And that's creating a massive amount of confusion. You know, people are just kind of, our customers are just like everybody's AI, like all their existing vendors now are like, oh, we're AI ops now. It's like, okay, but you haven't changed anything, right? You're still a legacy vendor that we've been having for 15 years. You haven't even upgraded software in 12 months, like, but now you're an AI ops platform. So right now we're just really trying to help our customers kind of weed through a lot of the confusion of that.
But it's not only the vendors, actually. I also observe this with customers that, you know, if you get these RFQs or RFPs and they're saying, you know, can you use advanced machine learning to do whatever? So, sure you can, but there's an easy way to do it with, you know, where you don't need it, but because it sounds good on the requirements sheet, some people ask for it without, you know, having entirely understood whether, you know, machine learning based technology might be the best way to tackle this problem, or whether there's actually something much simpler and that requires less data and so on. So, but yeah, I fully agree that it's very much a term that is en vogue and that everybody tries to jump on that bandwagon.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point too, because I think that confusion now is manifesting itself back out, right? There, and you know, they put a requirement in and say need to support, you know, machine learning and machine learning algorithms, but that's it. It's like, okay, well, without context, I don't really know how to respond to that, you know. And so we're still very much, I mean, every iteration of technology goes through a learning phase and an educational phase. And there's, you know, people who grasp onto it very, very quickly, like early adopters, and they go deep on it and they really want to understand it. And they're willing to assume some risk in doing that because the failure rate is probably a little bit higher. And then there's others who, you know, kind of are laggards that kind of come along after that, waiting for someone else to kind of make the mistakes. Mm-hmm. And I think we're very much in the beginning of this curve of, you know, working with early adopters and helping them, you know, who are trying to prototype and build out these things quickly. And then we're going to see a lot of education going on over the next couple of years, and then much more mainstream probably in 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that actually leads me to my next question. I mean, what's the state of AI ops in 2022? You've already mentioned a few things, but what I'm particularly interested in as well, you know, over the last 2 years or so, we've had this little thing called COVID that has, you know, accelerated some things enormously, like, you know, everything related to remote work and these kind of things. But it's also been, you know, has slowed down some other things. You know, around AI ops, have the last 2 years been more an accelerant or an impediment?
I don't think it's been really either. I don't think that AI ops has accelerated, you know, the deployment of AI ops, right? And within our customer base, we're still working with a lot of customers who are just trying to figure it out and just trying to say, what is the vision? How do I make the cost? How do I make the cost justification? What is the plan? We're seeing, you know, we're definitely seeing an increase with customers in deploying it. But I don't really know. I think we were so busy in the first 9 months of the pandemic of trying to figure out how to support everybody going working from home and all the security aspects and we saw a lot of customers making very, very quick moves and fast moves in security and things like that. Maybe some of the AI app stuff slowed down a little bit because they were just so busy in those first 9 months. Mm-hmm. But I think it's actually kind of moving along the path of where I thought it would be as far as a timeline of some new disruptive technology that comes into the market. Where we're seeing most people right now looking at AI ops, it's use cases around like event management, monitoring, observability. And that's where we're seeing, you know, 95% of the use cases of our customers saying, hey, and it makes sense, right? Because as you said, data, right, it relies on data, and there's just tremendous amounts of monitoring data coming in now. Mm-hmm. So, but what we really try to work with our customers on is saying, look, AI ops is really a strategy. It's not a technology, right? And when you say, if you break it down and say AI and ops, you know, ops is a pretty big domain, right? I mean, mm-hmm, you've got definitely. Not just monitoring observability, you got configuration management, you got provisioning activation, you've got customer support and end user support. And those are where tools like ITSM come in and data analytics and Splunk and, you know, things like that. So it's a complex environment. So when you say ops and the royal term of ops, then that's a pretty big area. And if you now apply AI to it, you have to start thinking about, okay, how do I apply, you know, machine learning, AI, whatever we want to call it, into my operations environment? And now it becomes a much bigger conversation. And some of it's going to happen. Some of it's going to happen automatically because vendors are going to start deploying machine learning into their platforms, whether you like it or not, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's going to happen, right? It's just, you know, 5 years from now, you know, most platforms are going to be using some sense of machine learning, right, to process data. But we're already seeing it in things like, so if you think of ITSM, right, as part of the operations domain, well, we're starting to see that, right? We're seeing AI, you know, ServiceNow with their virtual chatbots and delivering AI technology into the virtual chatbots for more conversational, non-human interaction, right? So it's going to start proliferating all through this. And one of the things that we tell our customers is, you know, kind of step back and say, okay, what's the vision of what we're trying to do here? Like, what does the impact of this have to our operations domain? And where do we want to make bets? Where do we want to make investments? What is the timeline to do that? Where do we start? What are the use cases we're trying to solve? Because it's going to have ramifications for customers around behavior of their staff, right? Because processes are going to change. You know, if you've got machine learning now that's able to go and gather lots of different data and process things, you're going to have a different process for incident resolution, right, than you did, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. before this. And that's going to change behavior. And then you're going to have all kinds of really weird, you know, not weird things, but natural things going on where people get nervous. You know, like, is my job at stake? And, you know, do you have the right skills, right? Because most IT organizations don't have the skills to run an AI ops strategy, right? They don't have data scientists, they don't have modelers and things like that. So they're going to have to start looking at skills. Can you retrain people? So there's going to be a fair amount of organizational contention going on during this too, just because mm-hmm. people are naturally, when they don't understand, they make their own decisions, and they make their own decisions in a selfish manner. That's how humans work. And it's up to the leadership to really create this vision and communicate it and let everybody know what role they play and where they might be transitioning in the future.
Yeah, definitely. What you mentioned is a very important point. I actually recently had a conversation for another episode of this podcast, which isn't published yet as we're recording this. So I won't get ahead too much, but we talked about exactly these things. And it's a company, I think I would consider them, you know, early adopters of AI ops. And, you know, they also mentioned the things that they do with these chatbots. You mentioned where, you know, the chatbot can basically tell you if you have a problem, you know, is this, you know, are you experiencing a network problem, or is the server of the application that you're trying to access as a problem, or might it be a problem on your own machine? These kind of questions, this chatbot solution can answer. So that's pretty interesting, and I imagine that it reduces the amount of sort of calls to the service center or, you know, first line support or whatever you call it. But it has all the ramifications that you mentioned on the organization. So, yeah, we'll talk about that in the other conversation a bit more. On the Windward blog, you recently published some AI ops predictions for the year 2025. Where do you see things going? You alluded to a few things, and where, you know, and I think you interviewed 10 vendors or so. Where do they invest and where do they put their chips?
Yeah, so the underlying theme that when I talk to a lot of vendors, not only, you know, through these studies that we do, but also on my podcast, and we rebranded the podcast as the Find Flow podcast. And really they're talking a lot about data, right? And rightly so. Because vendors, you know, technology vendors are very good at creating technology to solve some type of problem. And so most of the conversations we're having right now around data, we're talking to, you know, vendors about automation of data feeds and auto discovery of data feeds and auto, you know, automating kind of the consumption of data. But that's a relatively complex thing because you have to find the data and then you have to actually do data transformation and mapping and all kinds of things like that. And then you got to make sure that your data is clean. Right. And, you know, so if you've got, you know, we've got customers, I've worked with customers who have a CMDB and they're like, oh, we're going to connect into that. We want to do some correlation of event data to, you know, service mapping. And then you look at the CMDB and half the data is missing. Right. So it's like, okay, it's not really that useful, right? Because your CMDB is, you know, not being maintained or not being, the data is not there. You have a CMDB, but it's like half populated. So that doesn't really help us. So that's most of the conversation with vendors right now that we're kind of talking about is how to really consume this data. And obviously the next step is, okay, how do you build out the models and how do you, how do you tweak algorithms and things like that? Where vendors in general miss, and this is not a slam on them because they play a very pivotal role in creating this technology, is the implementation of that technology is complex, and adoption of technology is complex, and context is complex, right? So you and vendors, you know, they need to build a platform that kind of responds to the masses, right? If you don't, and you build a platform that's highly customizable to every single customer, then you're essentially building a consulting practice, right? So you want to build, you know, they want to build a platform that kind of responds to the masses. The issue with that, though, is that when you go in to any particular customer, every customer has their own context, right? Of how they do business, how they do work with customers, what their customer expectations are, what their agreements are with their customers. So these platforms have to be tweaked and they have to be adjusted. And that takes, you know, understanding of the context of the environment, and it takes understanding of the technology, it takes an understanding of processes and things like that. So that's where we come in, right? So we come in and we work with these vendors and we say, okay, now we understand your platform. We understand the strengths and weaknesses. Everyone has strengths. Everyone has weaknesses. Not a bad thing. It's just the way the world works. Now let's take this platform and put it into and wrap it in context so that we can maximize the strengths and minimize any of the weaknesses. So that's, you know, that's where we're kind of really working with some of these vendors right now. And it's an exciting time, you know, because, you know, we're really doing some really new stuff now. And the potential, I think, is just amazing.
Now, you mentioned that you know, we're still in the early adopter phase, and, you know, this is just, the wave is just getting started. You know, what are the challenges that you see companies face when they, you know, start to dip their toe into the AI ops waters?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I sit on a we run a customer group around AI ops, and it's we have every once in a while. I mean, we do it monthly, and we have anywhere from 30 to 50 customers on at any given time, or prospects, or just people in the industry wanting to kind of get in on the conversation. And it's kind of like a peer advisory group. And what I'm really surprised by is just, you know, a lot of customers are just still trying to figure out, or prospects are trying to figure out, how do we do this? Like, how do we even make the justification? There's a funny thing going on that goes on in the operations world. And most people don't know about it, but I'm sure you do. And that is, there's a lot of tools and technologies in this operation domain, like a lot, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I built Red Monocle specifically to go after investment strategies around technology. And we've got, you know, customers that have 100 different tools. A lot of them duplicate. A lot of them aren't being used well. They're not integrated together. So it's a complex world. And that's how operations environments generally are around the world. And so when you go to, you know, you say, hey, I think it's time for us to start looking at an AI ops implementation and a strategy. And you go to your director or your vice president and you try to make the case, inevitably, they're going to say, you know what, we got enough tools around here, make it work, right? Figure it out. And then you've got to make the justification, right? And you've got to basically go in and say, look, if we implement this technology, we can reduce these three other technologies and it can pay for itself, or we can tie it to the business. We can deliver better service. We can tie it directly to the lines of business. So I think, you know, there's an enormous, and I think this is back to the hype cycle, right? Of there's a lot of early adopters, some early adopters right now, and there's a lot of people in that next phase trying to figure out, I'm not an early adopter, but I'm not a laggard. I'm in that little next phase of how do I start, you know, learning and doing this at a much lower risk and taking the time to educate myself and not really kind of jumping into the deep end of the pool like some other of the early adopters do. And that's where we see really the vast majority of people that are getting in on the AI ops conversation is like, how do we make the case? Like, how do we convince people that we want to do this? Because we're going to have to spend money, and you know, we're potentially moving into a global recession, and money is a premium. And this is a time where operations teams basically get told you got to cut budget with no really justification of how they're actually going to do it. And so there are a lot of customers right now kind of in this phase right now, just trying to figure out, okay, how do we do this? How do we make the case? How do we? And the challenge they have is that they don't understand the space. They don't understand AI ops and the whole space and what's going on. They don't understand the technology. And a lot of times they don't necessarily have a close enough tie to their business mm-hmm. where they could go out to the lines of business and say, hey, look, let's partner with you and how we can deliver better service for you, deliver faster, more reliable service to you. And what does it mean when we don't do that? And make that case. And you know, one really good example is we have a customer who basically they manufacture home goods, consumer healthcare products, you know, toothpaste and things like that. And they actually went out to the manufacturing line and they sat down with the project foreman on that line and they understood, okay, how what happens in instant. Now, what happens if the line goes down for 15, 20 minutes? Well, that 15, 20 minutes doesn't mean they produce less product. It means that they extend the line, they extend the schedule, and then they start paying overtime. So there is a cost associated with that. And they were actually able to working with the business saying, for every minute of downtime of the manufacturing line, it costs us $100,000, right? Mm-hmm. And they brought that back to the business and back to their management team and say, look, if we can start getting smarter at consuming this data and running, you know, pattern matching and isolating problems so we can reduce a line outage from, you know, 5 minutes to 30 seconds or even reduce it entirely, we've got an ROI of $500,000, right? Mm-hmm. And that's it. Those are the more exciting conversations, I think. But that's where we see a lot of them. The other thing that, you know, the people who've kind of jumped into the deep end of the pool, Most of them are spending, you know, their first use cases around incident problem management, and really focusing on maybe one or two use cases right now, getting those things solid that they can then go out and start talking, you know, to the rest of the business about how to expand the technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So you mentioned this earlier, if you extend what AI ops can do and sort of the logical extension of AI ops is autonomous resolution of issues. You know, we're basically, you know, the issue is detected, analyzed, and remediated completely autonomously without any human interaction. The promise of that sounds great, but it doesn't come without risks. And we've seen, at least I remember distinctly, one cloud provider that had something like that in place, and it ended up crashing their entire cloud for 2 days. What are some best practices when it comes to this, you know, first automating IT operations, then, do you say, autonomizing IT operations?
Yeah, I like autonomic operations. That's kind of a term that I started throwing out there years ago. And this really goes back to our days at RealOps when we built our, you know, runbook automation and orchestration platform. But I think you're absolutely right. Ultimately, where we're getting to, right, the big promise, as you say, is a fully automated remediation strategy. I think we're a long way away from that. And it's going to be an incremental process. And I think it's a combination of understanding, you know, companies trusting technology to auto remediate. And I'm not sure that trust is very high right now. And the other is understanding the automation and understanding, and really you've got to deep dive into how to templatize these remediation processes. And then ultimately you've got to be able to have the technology to do that. You know, so if you look at like, excuse me, if you look at like car manufacturing, you know, you can have robots that weld, right? And mm-hmm. they do one thing well. Certainly there's error correction inside of that. So if a piece doesn't line up exactly where they think they weld, they detect that and they will stop welding, or they won't weld, you know, off the seam. IT is just far more complicated than that, right? There's way more pieces and parts to the solution. You've got cloud infrastructure, you've got storage, you've got microservices, you've got all these different components down to applications, and it's a complex environment. And so in order to get to this promise, you're going to have really strong supporting systems. Like, you're going to have incredibly accurate CMDBs. Right. Mm-hmm. Because in order to understand how to remediate a problem, you're going to have to actually understand how the component that you're trying to remediate is constructed. Right. And I think there's a lot of work that companies need to be doing around CMDB accuracy. Mm-hmm. And and that's where AI can come in too. Right. The application of machine learning and AI into the CMDB space and the configuration management space, in my mind, could be transformational, because that's been an area in operations that's been really, really hard to crack. Is mm-hmm. you can build a CMDB, but how do you keep it accurate? Mm-hmm. And how do you keep it accurate in the face of cloud, where your services now are becoming much more dynamic, and they're becoming more dynamic every single day? So applications are actually changing dynamically, and how do you understand something that's changing dynamically, right? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. That's, you know, the promise of automation, I think, is, I mean, honestly, I think we're probably a decade away, you know, from mm-hmm. from really, you know, having autonomous. And this is, and the vendors are going to have to really play a big part in this too. And it's not only the software vendors, but a lot of the infrastructure vendors, where they can make the technology much more templatized and build in automated routines inside of their own technology. We saw this with Cisco, right? I mean, back in the day, we would, you know, we would basically build double networks, right? In case something went down. Well, now, I mean, Cisco's built so much auto routing, remediation, network infrastructure that, you know, you don't have to do that anymore because Cisco really kind of took care of that network layer and translated all that into, you know, software WAN and software networking. So it's going to take a collective, you know, it's going to take a collective industry to really get to this promise. And the more, you know, the other, I think the other challenge that, and this is going back, you know, years and still is a problem today, is there's this idea of automation, and I kind of break it down into two types, task automation and end-to-end automation. And task automation is basically things that we've been doing for the last 15 years, right? You're in a NOC, talk to anybody who's working a NOC, and they've written scripts, right? And they've written scripts, and those scripts execute, you know, either through command line or through cron or whatever, right? Or they can be executed from an event. Event comes in and actually calls on a bash script. It does something that, and the challenge is that a lot of environments have written hundreds of these scripts. You know, I have customers that have written thousands of these scripts, and these scripts are running and nobody really knows them, knows what they are doing, where they're doing. They're not well documented. They're not well inventoried. So we have to kind of get that under control. But I think the real value in this promise that you talk about is the end-to-end automation. And that's taking a lot of these task-based scripts and piecing them together. And that's where orchestration comes back in, is how do I connect into all these different systems to execute tasks? And then the value of that task is then transferred to the next task, so it can make a decision based on the value of the decision of the task that was done before it, you know, so parent child sequential type thing. And that's what we were doing with RealOps back in the day, is being able to integrate into all these different systems and create conditional logic that allows us to say, if this task runs and it returns value A, B, or C, if it's A, do this task, if it's B, do that task, if it's C, do that task. And that's ultimately, you know, that's why this is going to take so long, because that's what humans do, right? And humans are now, they're logging into this system and they're looking at it and they're making a decision and like, oh, based on what I'm seeing, I'm going to go do this over here. And if we're going to get to this promise of automation, we've got to replicate that thinking and that decision-making across multiple systems. Because again, operational domain has a lot of different tools and we've got to be able to replicate that. And I think it's a long way away.
Yeah, and this one very important aspect that you mentioned sort of in passing is the question of data integrity, you know, of these grown systems that have grown over 20 years. And, you know, I think it, you know, the saying is true here as it is everywhere, garbage in, garbage out. I'm particularly interested in the CMDB space that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. What's some of the work that's going on there to improve this perennial problem of CMDBs being accurate for about 0.5 seconds and then being outdated?
Yeah, that's a huge challenge. And you know, we work with a lot of customers on that. And, you know, right now it's there's so much human interaction that goes into CMDB right now. And as we know, processes, if they're not followed, you know, you end up with, you know, just bad data. Structurally, a lot of customers haven't deployed CMDBs in the way that we recommend. So we spend a fair amount of time right now in kind of restructuring some of these CMDBs, looking at auto discovery technologies, and really, you know, auto discovery is really kind of one of the key parameters of the CMDB. And really making sure that the auto discoveries are configured correctly and configured in the right intervals and are collecting the right amount of data, and tying that into cloud infrastructure and really building, we're doing a fair amount of work in API integration, especially with some of these cloud vendors, to ensure that the data is updating into the CMDB as fast as possible. Yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges. And I think that, honestly, I think CMDB is the core of everything, right? It's your knowledge base. And if your CMDB is off, you're just going to have so many issues downstream, right? And a lot of organizations kind of deploy their CMDB as part of another implementation and then kind of moved on. And we're working with a lot of customers right now going back and kind of saying, hey, look, we've got to spend a fair amount of time on the CMDB, because you can't just deploy the CMDB as part of your ServiceNow ITSM implementation and call it a day, right? You've got to go back and start looking at how do we get the data accurate? How do we know when the data is not accurate, right? And that's a key thing, is like alerting ourselves to understanding we've got data issues. Whether it's missing data or inaccurate data, building parameters around understanding how to make the data more visible to people. But it's really the key to everything, because you can't do root cause analysis without understanding of your environment. And if you don't have a good CMDB, you're just going to have a really hard time doing that.
Yeah.
And we've seen some platform vendors basically trying to skirt around that, and say, well, we have our own auto discovery technology that will go out. And I'm like, okay, now you're running multiple discovery technologies on the infrastructure. And
yeah, there should be a single source of truth. We had this discussion at our user conference earlier this year, where one of our partners presented an integration between sort of the dynamic configuration management of our software of CheckMK with generic CMDB connector, let's call it this way. Mm-hmm. And there was exactly this discussion, what should be the single source of truth, what the monitoring tool discovers or what the CMDB actually has inside it. And so I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah, I think the thinking of CMDB has changed a lot over the years. When CMDB was first kind of rolled out, and Remedy, BMC Remedy was kind of one of the leaders of that back in the day, we're talking 15 plus years ago. The idea was, well, everything goes into CMDB. So we just put everything into CMDB. That became unfeasible, right?
And I mean, with containers that live for a minute, that's pretty hard.
It's very hard. And it's also, it's probably not the best way of doing it. So one of the things that we started talking about at RealOps, 15 years ago, was this idea of federated CMDBs, right? So you have a CMDB that basically becomes the source of the metadata, right? And then it actually points to the source of that may have the most accurate data. So like your case, your software may have the most accurate data because you're discovering it dynamically. So let's go to that source and let's grab that data as we need it. And not necessarily try to copy everything, because that's what strategy of the past was, let's copy everything. And I think that idea of let's copy everything into the CMDB still lives out there. I mean, you got a lot of, you think about it, people who are management positions or in their, mid 30s to say 40s that are now director level, VP level, they started their career 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, 15 years ago, that was the mentality. So their career was built on certain preconceptions of like how things should be done. And a lot of that kind of continues to live on. So it's changing mindsets of how to do, CMDB.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. There's one more switching topics just a little bit. You said, one of the main applications today of AI ops is the whole event management, event correlation field. If something goes wrong on one end of the infrastructure, what other events might be correlated with that? What are some best practices, some ideas that you've seen that are kind of interesting, and also companies that might be interested in, starting to look at these things? Good points to get started there.
We're big advocates of starting small and growing from there, and that's a double-edged sword, and I'll get to that in a second. But most of like when we start with customers, we basically say, okay, let's start with very defined area and let's then start building upon that. And you might look at it and say, okay, let's focus on a particular application. So let's work on your online banking application. And that online banking application may be incredibly complex, right? I mean, it may be, you know, spread across global data centers and things like that, but in itself, it's an application. And at that point, we can basically say, okay, if we can focus in on that, what we can do is we can start looking at the data sources that are being collected around that application. And okay, we need to connect data from Splunk because a lot of the logging information coming in from different components is going to Splunk. Okay, let's build a connector into Splunk and then let's, you know, start modeling that. Okay, do we understand the configuration and the components of it? Are they dynamic or are they static? Okay, they're running the cloud environment, yet they're relatively static. Okay, let's look at certain aspects of the CMDB that we can pull in to start correlating, you know, the relationship between these components. So that's really where we start, is we try to get very defined into a single use case around maybe an application or a business process, something that's relatively critical, right? Because we want visibility. And I mean, we're collecting data, so we're basically, a lot of times we're running next to their existing monitoring infrastructure. So we haven't replaced anything yet. And we're running kind of in parallel. We're bringing the data in and we're modeling it. And then we're able to show differences between the AI ops driven use case versus the legacy application. And again, what we're trying to do here is we're trying to educate, prove out, and really make more visible the potential of this technology. So that's, we recommend it a lot. The double-edged sword here is, and I see this often, is not, if you don't, if you kind of focus in on this business application and you're not really stepping back ahead of time and building a vision, then what ends up happening fairly often is during the process of acquiring technology for this new use case, because you may say, hey, we're going to look for a new vendor that's got, you know, a much more machine learning driven algorithms in their platform. And we're going to make an investment in that as part of this prototype. You get very myopic in the sales cycle of that use case, right? Because during the sales cycle of bringing in this technology, you're defining what are you going to use it for, how you're going to use it, what is the impact. You're setting all these expectations with the vendor and the consulting partner around that use case. What ends up happening a lot is as that use case is successful and starts getting visible, if you haven't developed a vision of this and actually propagated the vision prior to doing this deployment, you're now trying to figure out how to expand it. And you're like, okay, we were really successful here. Let's go expand it. And you got to go talk to another group and they're not necessarily interested. And you're like, well, you know, this is how we do it. And this is how we've been doing it. And we're cool with it. And we don't need this. And you're like, oh, and we see that a lot with that first use case is we're having a lot of friction translating it into other organizations and getting on board because they're like, look, I don't want to use this new system. I've been using this and we're fine with it. It's like, yeah, but here's all the value proposition. Yeah, I understand that, but you know what? I got other things I want to do. So that's why the vision is really, really critical, right? Mm-hmm. And it's because it lays the groundwork ahead of time that we're doing this and you get your management on board, especially management that all these other organizations roll up into, so they become your advocate. So the the leadership basically says, hey, we ran this prototype. It's panning out pretty well. We want to expand it. Now I want you three organizations to get on board, as opposed to our customer, who's potentially maybe lower level, having to go out and try and sell it. So that's where we see really the kind of the environment right now is people working in these prototypes and then trying to expand it, and us, you know, doing those prototypes and then helping them, you know, articulate the value proposition. And I hear that from a lot of vendors. You know, vendors are frustrated because they're like, we're not getting the expansion that we thought we were going to get. There's too much friction, too much challenge, too much a wall to get over. It's like, yeah, because you didn't do the upfront work. right? You didn't bring them into the tent, these other organizations into the tent. You know, the next three or four critical applications, you should have been talking to them about this technology, you know, as in alongside of what you're trying to do for your own business case.
Mm-hmm. So you would you go so far as to say that sort of a critical success factor for the implementation of anything related to AI ops on a larger scale, let's not say on a sort of point solution, is really to have, you know, the top down buy in and rather, you know, bring it in from the top rather than sort of organically growing, being adopted within the organization?
I just find organically growing just is so slow. It's, you know, we are human beings, and you know, you just need to understand the human condition, right? And we like comfort, and generally most people don't like change. Very, very few people like change. So you're just going to run up against behavioral resistance. And so if you can get your leadership involved, and the thing is, it's not really hard, right? Because we're talking about some pretty cool stuff, right? And we're talking about exciting technology and exciting improvements in the operations world. And that doesn't come along a lot. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years, and we don't have a lot of exciting things going on in the operations world. You know, you and I may think so, but in general, it's not, right?
I mean, it's almost the purpose. It shouldn't be too exciting, because exciting always means that there's stuff exploding and things.
Yeah, exactly. No news is good news, you know? Right?
Yeah,
right, that's the thing. Right? But operations is a really hard world, right? You got people that are, you know, working 24/7, they're on pagers, they're doing, you know, P1 outage meetings on Saturdays and Sundays, and you've got maintenance windows where people are on call during maintenance. I mean, it's a tough world. It's a tough life. And you know, so when you bring something along that's exciting, say, hey, look, this can change the dynamics of how we do things in a really positive way. It gets leadership pretty excited. So I don't think it's a hard thing to do. It's just we just find that a lot of our customers and a lot of prospects are just not approaching that way. And maybe they're scared. You know, maybe they're like, look, I don't want to oversell it. You know, I don't want to oversell this thing, and then if it doesn't work, you know, or it doesn't deliver what we think it's going to do, then I'm going to look bad. You know, so I understand that too. So it all comes down to
also might not be entirely sure where in the hype cycle we are. We're already, you know, over the peak of overinflated expectations, or whether we're still approaching that. So yeah, I get it.
Yeah, I think we're very much on the beginning of the hype cycle, right? I don't think we're not at the top at all. I think we're years away from being at the top of the hype cycle. But so that's hard, right? I mean, if you work in a conservative organization, that may be a hard thing to do, and it may not be, you know, personally, career-wise, something that you want to rock the boat, right?
But
a lot of our work that we're doing, I mean, we do a lot of work with financial institutions and healthcare companies. Financial institutions, you know, especially the larger ones, I'm not talking about kind of regional banking and things like that, but larger ones, they're all on bleeding edge, right? And they like to take risks, and they like to be in forefront. And there's business value for them to do that too, because they see a lot of technologies and especially in the investment banking world, they see a lot of technologies that they might, you know, proof of concept as part of their due diligence of maybe supporting them from an investment banking customer or something like that.
That's very interesting what you're saying, because if I look at this sort of from a European lens, sort of you would put like financial institutions way towards the back of, the early adopters of technologies. But I was about to ask you that, because there's this quote, I don't remember who said it, but you know, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. What are some of the industries that you see sort of on the forefront of what's going on here, and what are maybe some industries or company types that you know are maybe a few years behind? And you mentioned, you know, financial institutions are on the bleeding edge. Some others that come to mind?
Yeah, I'll start on the other end of the spectrum. and this is really just a U.S. perspective, because we don't, any work that we do in Europe is really U.S. companies, you know, expansion over there. Government is on the far end of the bottom of the spectrum as far as movement. I mean, you can assume that the government is anywhere from 3 to 5 years behind industry. and I mean industry as a whole, not even early adopters. You're looking at energy companies are probably down in that area. That's starting to change a little bit, especially with as companies are moving into more renewable energy, which is much more technology based, you know, whether it's wind or solar and things like that. But generally, energy companies are on the bottom. I mean, financial services, and I talk about large financial services. I mean, we're talking about, you know, investment banks primarily out of some of the bigger cities of New York, San Francisco. I say Charlotte, but most of the banks out of Charlotte are now all owned by banks in New York. So the investment banking, large scale, you know, your Goldman's, Morgan's, things like that, they're always on the bleeding edge. I mean, I read something a couple months ago that one out of four employees at Goldman Sachs is now a technologist, right?
Yeah. So I read something similar that, like, I think it was also one of the top banks that they're looking for more tech people. Like, if you look at their job openings than any other function. So that would corroborate that.
Yeah, I think you're even seeing that in, I mean, I'm not an investment guy, but I mean, as you start seeing like computer modeling for financial management, you know, you're starting to see that more, right? You know, PhDs coming out of MIT going to work for investment banks, building models. It's all math, right? In the end. I would say healthcare, health services are probably in the middle. Some a little bit more progressive, leaning towards early adopters. I think, you know, we've got a number of customers that are kind of disruptive technology companies within different sectors. So we've got one company that's pretty really progressive, and they're in the real estate business, which you would think, oh, that's about the bottom of. But they're a disruptor. They're a technology disruptor in that space. So. Any of the technology companies that are large enough but disrupting traditionally conservative spaces, which is probably why they're in business, right? Is that they're going in saying, look, this is a perfect industry that's been slow to change that we can disrupt. They're pretty progressive when it comes to technologies like this.
Yeah, makes sense. Sean, I think this is a great point to sort of end our discussion on AI ops. You know, towards the end of our episodes, we always have these short, tongue-in-cheek, rapid-fire questions that I'd like to ask you a few of. So, how old were you when you started dabbling with computers?
Oh gosh, I think I had my first computer when I was a freshman in college, so I would have been probably about 18. And I had a better computer than I had a screaming fast 286 computer with something like, I don't know, 512 of RAM or 256 of RAM and a 4 megabyte hard drive or something.
That's what I was
like
about
that.
To say. We're talking kilobytes here. We're not talking megabytes.
No, there was no G's back there. My college that I went to, we were still running off of VT100 mainframes, you know. So. I was actually ahead of that, and then that got me really into, you know, computing, because I was pretty early on in that, and so.
So and how old were you when you broke? Did you break that first computer, or did it take a few generations until you broke your first computer?
No, I think I broke my first computer. Probably a couple of years after that. And it probably was a work computer too. I think I had a better computer than my first job out of college. And I remember I was back in the day when, you know, if you had to do a memo, you had to take it to the receptionist, right? And she would type it up and she put it on carbon paper and everybody would sign it and send around a paper file. And then it would take like 4 days to get a memo out the door. When I was working at my first job at the government, I think they gave me a computer. I'm pretty sure I broke that a few times and, you know, so they weren't happy with me.
All right. Now today, are you a Linux guy? Are you Mac or are you Windows?
I am pretty much a Mac guy. I won't say pretty much. I am a Mac guy. I'm true and true Apple fanboy. I pretty much buy what I mean. I don't even go into an Apple store anymore because I pretty much have one of everything in there. And some of it's even sitting in boxes.
You have your own Apple store.
Yeah. It's a little fetish of mine, which I call it a hobby. But I've been using Apple. When I left the government, I went to work for Booz Allen Hamilton, which was a large consulting company, and they were all Mac. And I had like the very first PowerBook, you know, it was like the gray thing. It had little feet that you turned down to elevate it. And on the side had feet. The screen was like, I don't know, 8 inches monochrome screen. And, I remember when the new ones came out, the black ones came out and they had color screens. They're still like, you know, 8 or 9 inches. I've worked with Windows in the past, obviously. Most of my work is on Linux, right? Mm-hmm. We do, you know, customer deployments and things like that. So I'm a Mac guy, Unix guy in the end.
All right. And if you'd had to choose, I mean, I know that the answer is rarely, either or, but if you had to choose, you know, cloud or on-prem?
Oh, I'm cloud all the way. I'm cloud, baby, all the way.
All right.
We started transitioning Winward to all cloud applications, SaaS applications. We moved all our lab equipment into the cloud years ago. And I tell you, when the pandemic hit, it was awesome. It was seamless for us. We just walked out of the office and went home and didn't skip a beat. And all my software companies, when we started RealOps back in the day, that was on-prem. RedMonocle and App47 were all cloud-based applications. And I tell you, it's night and day. And as a developer, I mean, the cloud is developing applications on the cloud. This is so much easier. Delivering to customers is easier. Support is easier. It's just, so I'm all in on cloud.
All right. Sean, this has been a pleasure. Really interesting to do this sort of deep dive on AI ops and where we stand in the year 2022 on this. Thank you so much for your
time.
Thank
you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Is there anything, you know, that you, an ask or something that you're particularly interested in that people can reach out to you about, who you want people to talk to about? Anything come to mind?
No, I mean, obviously we're doing a lot of work. We're leading the charge in AI ops and we're super excited about that. But like, as we talked about, you know, a good AI ops strategy is built on the foundation of everything else, right? It's built on the foundation of ITSM and CMDB and configuration management and all those aspects. And so if you want some advice, I mean, you can hit our website at winward.com, winward.com. I think it goes /resources. There's all kinds of stuff on there that we're writing about AI ops to learn about it. You can learn some of the new things we're doing in ITSM and CMDB and configuration management. Or you can follow us on our podcast, the Find Flow podcast, just on all the platforms and YouTube. Just Google Find Flow and we'll
all right. Great. What's the best, if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way? Is it LinkedIn, Twitter? Where can you be found?
You know, I'm old school. Just email me. You know?
All right.
You can email me at sean.mcdermott@winward.com.
All right. We'll put that in the show notes.
I check LinkedIn a lot, and I get so much spam in LinkedIn now. It's like crazy. So just email me. You know, I'm pretty accessible. I'm one of the more accessible people. So.
All right. Great. All right. We'll put all of that on the show notes. Also link to Windward, obviously. Sean, thanks for your time. This was super interesting. I learned a lot. I hope our audience does as well. And thanks for taking the time and being our guest.
Awesome. Thanks you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the All Things Ops podcast. If you liked this episode, leave us a review and subscribe on your favorite podcast player. This podcast has been brought to you by Tribe 29, the Check MK company. For more resources, head over to checkmk.com/podcast. If you want to send us feedback or suggest a guest, please drop us an email at podcast@checkmk.com. Until next time, happy monitoring.